Accession number 27083, Reel 21.
Specialist. You might get command of, for example, a minesweeper or something. You might get command as a lieutenant commander. As a subspecialist, you would not get a command ordinarily, apart from the gunnery or torpedo or navigation ship, until you were a commander. And anyway, it was a very good sharpening up of your professional knowledge and updating and so forth, and it was a good thing to do. And so I went in for this because I realized that I had all the expertise of all the subspecializations as my messmates on board. At least I hoped that they were good enough for it. And indeed, I think they were. And I took this thing, and I took all subjects, and so did Prince Philip at the same time, because he was then First Lieutenant of Chequers, not with the same Captain D, I may say, a very different man from my town. Yes, he was a fellow contender for taking the destroyer command exam because he was about to go in command of the Magpie, his first command. And where I was lucky enough to pass in all subjects, he was failed in torpedo anti-submarine. And the flotilla, as opposed to squadron, torpedo anti-submarine officer, was quite a character. And it took me long years to discover, which I did out shooting with him one day, as to whether he'd done this as a gimmick or whether it was for real. And it was for real that Prince Philip just hadn't done his prep for that particular expertise. And the flag officer of destroyers had said that he must retake the exam, which he did, and of course he passed and went on to command the Magpie. But it was an interesting situation. Anyway, I got through that, and that was a good and a very worthwhile tick in the box. And the next incident that came my way was the flotilla sports to be held in Malta. It wasn't just the flotilla sports, but it was really the fleet sports as well. But, of course, the flotillas were a major contributor to this. And I was determined that we should put in, from the minesweepers, we should put in a full entry to all the events. And we got volunteers for quite a lot. And to give a lead, I put myself in for the 200 and the 220, which was about my limit, I thought. And time ran on, and we got a full list in. And then towards the closing date, people started to fiddle about and drop out. And without getting into too much detail, suffice it to say that I found that despite all the persuasion that I could muster, I eventually had to relinquish my 200 and 220 to people who felt rather as I did about it, that was the most they could take. And I had to push myself up to the 400 and the 880, which I didn't enjoy much. However, we were in dock at the time, in refit, and I reckoned that once round the dock was about 440, and ipso facto twice round was 880. And the great day came up in Malta, and I think we started with the... Yes, that's right. We started with the 440. And as far as I was concerned, you did a bit of a sprint to start with, got yourself into a position, settled down to your pace, and hoped you had enough oomph left to do a sprint right at the end for the tape. When I thought that it was about time I settled down to my pace, I found that nobody else agreed, and they went on at the same pace. So I came in well last, and that was that. And a bit later on, same afternoon, we had the 880, and I knew they couldn't possibly maintain that pace all along. And I triumphed in the 880 because I wasn't last. But the only reason I wasn't last was because on the final corner, one chap fell out and was violently sick. It wasn't really my forte, but we'd fielded a complete team, and that was important. At about that time,
Sir Henry, while you're thinking about that, something's been mulling in my mind, which I think I must raise, and that is that you had met this extraordinary girl playing tennis.
I'm coming on to her, then.
Are you? Yeah. Oh, excellent. Yeah. Because she's disappeared from view, and yeah. I wondered where
she's about to reappear.
Yeah, well, thank you.
In fact, we could take her next. And why not? Yes, we'll take her next. I'd fallen madly in love with this handsome girl. And we were going at it fairly hot and strong whenever we were in Malta, but we were away a lot, of course. And I got asked up to Villa Pietà quite often and so on. I took her out a lot. And it was all going swimmingly. And I thought, right, enough is enough for this sort of thing. And maybe the time has come when I should pop the question, because I was quite determined that she was the girl for me. And I arranged, and she accepted, she didn't know what she was in for, I arranged to take her to the Phoenicia, which was, it's still going, it's about the only really decent hotel in Malta, still, by far the best. And I arranged that I should take her there for dinner. And I thought about this very carefully, and it all worked out, and I drove her, picked her up, drove her to the Phoenicia, and we had a cocktail or something first, and we went into the dining room in due course, and the wine waiter came up, and I ordered champagne, and I tell this story very much against myself. I'd hardly ordered it when Mary, this girl, turned to me and said, you know this business when the wine waiter comes back and he pours out a sip in your glass and you raise it to your lips and you taste it or pretend to taste it and then you nod and he pours it out. Yes, I said, rather wondering what was coming next. Well, she said, have you ever known anybody turn it away? No, I said, being an honest guy. No, I can't say I have. Well, I bet you would. And that put me on my mettle. So when the wine waiter came back with the champagne, he did this, and I took a sip. And I wrinkled my brow, and I pursed my lips, and I took a second sip. And I turned to the wine waiter and said, no, this won't do at all. This is hopeless, it's corked. And he looked horrified. And the head waiter came bustling up and there was a scene. And away he went. And I said, no, it's no good. If you haven't got another vintage, then we won't have any champagne. And we didn't. We had whatever it was. And it was... I don't know how long later, not very long, but say a year or two, when I was desperate for conversation with somebody, a very sticky person, at a dinner party. And I mentioned this. And you at least gave a bit of a grin as I said it. And this person did not. And it was another naval officer, and he was a good deal older and much senior to me. And he said, you should know that there are all sorts of things that champagne can and cannot be, but the one thing it cannot be is corked, which I didn't know. And that was that. Anyway, we went on, and we had a very good dinner. And I'd been at pains to be briefed, because, you know, how did you find out about this sort of thing? And I didn't want to declare my hand to either parent, both of whom had been very kind to me, in advance of the event. And my briefing was that my intended was 19, which I regarded as really the minimum age to avoid being accused of cradle snatching and so forth. And so, in due course, I
probably... You were in August 27.
I was then...
approximately?
I was 25, I think.
25.
Yes, I think there was an 8-year gap between us. Yes, I think that was it. Because I popped the question. She said she was far too young and turned me down flat. And I discovered she was 17 and not 19. And I was miserable. I was absolutely dejected. I'd never proposed before. I'd never really been in love before. And this was it. And it all came crashing down. And, of course, anything like that had occurred in Malta, certainly in those days. And it was around the island in a flash, the whole island. And everybody, the entire, destroyer fleet, knew of it. And so did my captain, because he would have been told by his many girlfriends and so on. And he remarked, I think, to the first lieutenant that he was really used to people who had got engaged when perhaps they shouldn't have done, rather than the other way around. And he didn't know how to handle this and so forth. And he made remarks to me like, oh, nice girl, Mary, yes, nice girl. Which practically caused me to burst into tears on the spot, of course. And I was very, very emotional about it. So it was a very unhappy time. And at about that point, the captain MS changed. And Keith Campbell Walter left, and he was relieved by a man called Nick Copeman, who I think... later, of course, became CNC South Atlantic and South Africa, and ended up as controller of the Navy, I think. Different personality altogether. Perfectly nice man, very nice man. Not particularly good looking, as his predecessor had been. Not one for chasing the girls, as his predecessor had been. clever, very, well, fairly by the book, was a torpedo anti-submarine specialist, subspecialist, and so knew all about minesweeping and so forth. They didn't actually know how we did it in the Met. I need to say we did it in a different way to the norm, and so on. But a terribly nice man. And by this time, we had settled down as really, looking back on it, a very fine team on board the Leader. It had to be so, and it was so. And we were all interlocked, and we were all chums. And, dare I say it, we all knew our business pretty well. And so we were able to take a little bit of license. And it took the form of practical joking, and we would tend to put each other's legs, even while in the middle of doing something that actually mattered. But you had to be careful not to overstep the mark. All of which, of course, was strange to the new Captain MS. And one of the things we developed, and it emerged, I can't remember how it started, I think it emerged from a film we'd seen, where it was a Western, and people would draw their guns and they'd go shh, but it was always a double. And it was childish, really, that you could see aft to the sweep deck from the bridge, and needed to do so, of course, when you were on the job. And the torpedo officer was on the sweep deck. He would suddenly peer around the sweep deck. And if he got that in before you'd retaliated, you know, that was... it really was kindergarten stuff. But it had set in, and it was rife. And we all did it. And what the new Captain MS thought, I don't know. Because things had got to such a pitch that if it really mattered, you had to prefix the order or whatever that you were giving by No Joe, which was short for No Joke. Otherwise it didn't get done, or we got a comical reaction. And that really had taken it a bit too far, but it's what had happened. Well, there we were. And in due course we left, sailed from Malta, under the new boss, and back we went to the Greek islands and did our busy sweeping and so forth. And we began to have one quiet, so-called, weekend off. We won't get to sweep on the Saturday, nor, of course, on the Sunday. And on the Saturday morning, I think it was, yes, at 9 o'clock or so, Captain MS sent for me as flotilla sports officer and said, Guns, I want you to organize a flotilla boxing championship. We'll have it tomorrow, and we'll have it ashore. Virtually uninhabited Greek island sort of thing. That was really all he said. So I whipped round the ships quickly and told the sports officers to muster teams of boxers and state their weights and so forth, and then proceeded to think about the practicalities as to how you establish a boxing ring on a desert island, which is what it amounted to. And eventually sort of drummed up some sort of thing where by each corner had holdfasts and so on, and we found some coloured bunting to wrap round the ropes and so on. And at some stage, I think this must have been into the Sunday morning, because the boxing championship wasn't going to occur until the afternoon, and it was going to end up as the sort of pinnacle with a barbecue in the evening. Oh, quite a good idea. But talk about making bricks without straw. It was quite something. And the Sunday morning, by which time I was rather short of sleep and very sunburned, because I couldn't take the sun at all well, and I intercepted a lorry of pretty scruffy chairs being taken to some local vino or somewhere. And I don't speak a word of Greek, but I managed to negotiate with this chap by sign language and that sort of thing, that for a couple of tots of rum or whatever, I would borrow his chairs for the day. And so it went on. And I told off three other commanding officers to act as judges. We didn't require a referee, I didn't think, for that sort of tempo of boxing and so forth. And by the luck of the Lord, it all went well. And looking back on it, it was one of the greater miracles of my younger life. Then, going on, the first lieutenant of the half leader, whose wife resided there, a very nice couple, and they organized a treasure hunt for the wardrooms. Actually, I think it was by invitation. And we started off with, we're back in Malta now. we started off at about 6 o'clock at his house, and we had a couple of drinks, and then we were given our first clues, and the usual sort of thing, you know, one thing led to another, and it was going to be by car, this treasure hunt. So you could get to everywhere you needed to go by car. And one clue would lead to another, and the final clue would lead you to a particular bar at the head of St. Paul's Bay, which was well up. And there we would foregather, just for the sake of foregathering, as it were. And from there, by this time it should be sort of 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, we would go up to Comino, which is the channel between Malta and Gozo, with a 200-foot cliff. And we would sit on the top of the cliff and have a midnight picnic. Fine. Wives included. There weren't very many wives, but there it was. Well, all this worked out splendidly, and we foregathered at the bar at the head of St. Paul's Bay. And as we were leaving, somebody said, race you to Comino. And by this time, we'd had a couple there at the bar, and the blood was up a bit. And so everybody acceded to this. And I don't know whether you know Malta, but when it's dry, as it is a lot of the time, the roads get so polished, as it were, that even if you take quite a gentle corner, quite slowly, the tires scream. And I was driving my little car, and I had two girls in it, and the husband of one. And the tire screams. And the girl sitting next to me lost it, literally. And the man sitting behind said, would you mind slowing down a bit? I wasn't going all that fast, but equally I didn't intend to be last. and said, would you mind slowing down a bit, because so-and-so is not very happy. So I slowed down. And then we got onto onto a bit of straight, and I went on a bit, and so forth. And we arrived more or less together at the assigned rendezvous overlooking the Comino Channel. And the idea was that we'd draw up in a sort of half moon and leave our side lights on, and we'd sit back against our own bumpers and have our midnight picnic. And that all happened, and like others, I wandered off into the background to have a pee. And I hadn't gone very far when my feet shot from under me, and I fell. And I don't know if you're familiar with the saying that in the last few moments before you die, you relive a great chunk of your more adventurous life. And then, of course, you've gone, and that's it. And this is true. And I relived a few moments of my more adventurous life. And I thought all sorts of things. I thought maybe it was just as well that Mary had turned me down. And it would have pity, because I might have got on a bit in the Navy, a bit anyway. But now that's all over, because I had it. And you thought all this. And then the next thing I knew was when my knees hit my chin. And I'd fallen, I don't know how far, not very, 12 feet or so. and I'd landed on a ledge, but we were on the cliff edge, and I knew that the height of the cliffs was 200 feet. So that gave me pause for thought, and I thought it. Went back.
May I interrupt?
Yep.
Which life was that now? Because I think you had...
I think that's about number six.
Number six.
I think it is. No, it's the fifth. I got it down here.
Ah.
It was the fifth out of my nine. Well, then we went back and we sat down at our backs or our bumpers and that sort of thing. And we had a jolly good midnight picnic. And in due course, we left. And that was it. We went our separate ways and so forth. I found I could hardly get up. I managed to get back. And next morning, or later that morning, I was so stiff and so bruised, I could hardly move. And it took a lot of explaining, because it was all pretty unconvincing stuff that there was. But it did prove to me that you did relive your brighter moments of life. One evening, when we were sweeping, and bear in mind, there were a lot of active mines still about, and a lot of sweeping still to be done. And late one evening, just as it was getting dark, we cut some mines, about five of them.
You cut the cables?
You cut the cables, which is what the sweep was all about. It cut the cables.
You cut the cables.
The mines came to the surface, and then you fired a one-inch boys anti-tank rifle, with which you had been supplied, at them. If you hit a horn, of course, it blew up, and that was spectacular. So you couldn't take the ship too close. So you had to be fairly accurate with your gunnery. But what you were trying to do was to pierce the outer shell of the mine so that the water would get in, the mine would sink, the self-destruct device in the mine would then operate, and it would sit in the bottom, but it would be harmless. It wouldn't rearm, and so forth. That was the plan. And we cut half a dozen mines or so. And it was just getting dark. So we had to move fast. And the torpedo anti-submarine officer, Ronnie Lancaster, who was a great friend, was on the bridge at the time, and so was I. And we each grabbed one of these things, and we opened fire. Of course, this was by searchlight then, and so forth. And you could usually hear a definite sort of ping if you'd hit the metal of the mine. We didn't hit a horn, we didn't blow anything up. But we had to fire quite a number of rounds. And the boys' anti-tank rifle it's a one-inch job, and it's a very unpleasant weapon. It has a crack like a mule. I think they're obsolete now. And so on. And in those days, one didn't really bother much about... there was no such thing as ear defenders as such. But you didn't bother much about cotton wool or ear plugs or anything of that sort, particularly if it was time-wise something of an emergency, as this was before it got too dark, or we or the mines drifted away, and so on. Well, we thought we'd scored hits on all these, and that was that. And we ran in to anchor for the night, usual thing. And got out of our rublies and changed into a Red Sea rig for dinner, and so on. In the course of which, one went through the staff office in order to get to the wardroom. And in the staff office sat the torpedo anti-submarine officer, looking rather gloomy, with his face in his hands, and various people went up to him and said, hello, Ronnie, what's up with you? Come along to the mess and have a glass of whiskey. And he stood there, sat there, absolutely boot, not having heard a word. And I remember the engineer officer. We had a very sprightly engineer officer then, a different one, who was very much a first 11 player. And he went up and he put his mouth close to this unfortunate officer's ear and shouted at him, "Ronnie, come to the Waldron and have a bottle of whiskey on me." And a torpedo submarine officer sat the boot. Well, eventually he was more or less pulled to his feet and taken to the Waldron and so forth. I wasn't much company for the rest of the evening because you couldn't hear a word, couldn't hear a sausage. And that was that.
He had perforated eardrums?
No, he was just deaf.
Just deaf.
And that was that. Next morning, and this of course was serious for him because it was his livelihood as an anti-submarine officer. Next morning I woke up and my pillow was covered in blood and I had popped an eardrum. And just as well too, because if I hadn't, I would have been probably permanently deaf in that ear. I'm still a bit more deaf than the other one. But, and he, you know, it took him the inside of a week, and he recovered. He was all right. But it was an interesting thing. The